From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Turkey's President Recep Erdogan said there's no way that Ankara will withdraw its troops from neighboring Iraq, despite demands raised by Baghdad that they be removed, adding that the issue is, quote, out of the question, closed quote. Speaking at a press conference Thursday, Erdogan said Turkish boots are on the ground in northern Iraq to train Kurdish Peshmerga forces and not for combat. He added that officials from Turkey, the U.S., and the government of the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region will hold a meeting December 21st. However, he did not say if Iraq's authorities would be participating in those talks. Tensions have been on the rise between Ankara and Baghdad since last Friday, when about 150 Turkish troops and tanks were deployed to a base in the Nineveh province without Baghdad's approval. Turkey had agreed not to send more troops into Iraq while refusing to withdraw those already in the country. However, Erdogan said Thursday that, quote, the number of our troops could increase or decrease according to the number of Peshmergas they are training, closed quote. At first, Baghdad attempted to settle the matter bilaterally with Ankara. Abbas al-Bayati is a member of Iraq's parliament.
Now we are trying to find solutions through the direct dialogue between our foreign ministry and the Turkish foreign ministry, as well as other negotiations between the two ministries. If that doesn't work, we will take other actions, and our last choice is to appeal to the United Nations.
When talks between the two countries were unsuccessful, Iraq reportedly asked NATO to pressure Ankara to withdraw the troops, but that effort apparently was also unsuccessful. Baghdad then decided to take the case to the UN Security Council. Press TV's Altaf Ahmad has more.
Iraq's foreign ministry has reached out to the five permanent member states at the United Nations Security Council, as well as other member states over the issue. Turkey has deployed troops to a military camp in the town of Bashiqa, near Iraq's northern city of Mosul. Ankara has also called on its nationals to leave Iraq's territory, except those present in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. Senior officials in Baghdad have told Press TV that Turkey is playing a very dangerous game in Iraq.
Turkey has been implicated in allowing Daesh militants to move freely through its borders to Iraq and Syria, to funnel arms and money, and has also been implicated in illegal oil trade with the terror group. And this has been documented by three states, Iraq, Iran, and Russia.
Head of Iraq's Security and Defense Committee, Hakim Azzamli, has also told Press TV that Turkey's move cannot be separated from U.S. plans to divide Iraq.
All the Americans want is to allow forces which will divide territory between Sunnis and Shiites and Arabs and Kurds. First, they allowed Daesh in. Daesh is facing major defeats. Now they are sending troops to Iraq. But point is, they want forces on the ground to dismantle Iraq.
We also asked Mr. Zamli why he believed the liberation of Ramadi is facing stalemate, given that the U.S. has dispatched 200 soldiers to Ain al-Assad Air Base in Anbar province recently.
The reason why Ramadi has not been liberated is U.S. interference. Had the Iraqi Air Force and troops been fighting without the presence of coalition forces and U.S. advisors, Ramadi would have been liberated in 2 weeks.
According to Iraqi officials, the Turkish advances into northern Iraq cannot be separated from the U.S. plans to divide up the country or from Ankara's ties to the black market oil trade run by Daesh. Now that Baghdad has chosen to appeal to the international community, calls on the central government to take military action are also rising. Altaf Ahmad, Press TV, Baghdad.
Meanwhile, it was announced that Turkey's president has met with the president of Iraq's Kurdistan region, Masoud Barzani. With Iraq's government now saying that Turkey is working with ISIS and that the U.S. is attempting to divide Iraq along ethnic lines, the narrative at the U.S. State Department is beginning to unravel, as evidenced by an exchange between a State Department spokesperson and a reporter from RT at Thursday's daily press conference. RT's Gayanchi Chikayan filed this report on her exchange with the State Department's John Kirby, who, despite the failure of bilateral talks to bear fruit, insisted that this was the avenue that Washington wants the parties to to pursue.
You have a situation where U.S. ally Turkey has deployed troops into Iraq without the permission of the Iraqi government. The Iraqi prime minister asked NATO to intervene and to put pressure on Turkey to get the Turkish troops out of northern Iraq. And this Wednesday, Turkey carried out airstrikes against Kurdish PKK forces in northern Iraq. And there is a real concern that Turkey is doing its own thing while using the fight against ISIL as a cover. The U.S., though, takes upon itself to invite forces from other countries into Iraq and Syria. The U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter this Wednesday was telling Congress that he personally reached out to 40 countries to ask them to commit special ops and other support. The Iraqi parliament has expressed concern that Iraq may be losing a say in what countries it wants to cooperate with and what countries it doesn't, to the point that the Iraqi parliament's Security and Defense Committee is calling for the review or cancellation of Iraq's security agreement with the United States. I asked Mr. Kirby whether the U.S. addressed the concerns of the Iraqi parliament's Security and Defense Committee. Mr. Kirby said he was unaware of the committee's concerns, but then our exchange took an unexpected turn.
The situation where the U.S. invites forces to Iraq and the U.S. is leading this coalition, but when something goes wrong, the U.S. says it's none of our business, like with the Turkish troops, you have to figure it out between yourselves. Should it be of no concern to Iraq?
Again, another ridiculous question. When have we ever said it's none of our business?
You are saying that about the Turkish troops.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that, I'll say it again, okay, we want this to be worked out bilaterally between Turkey and Iraq. And the way you're trying to twist all of this around to make it look like we're doing something nefarious or that we're, you know, we've got some sort of inappropriate relationships here. I mean, it's just so silly.
Well,
and
I can't believe, honestly, that you aren't embarrassed
to ask these questions.
Should I not be asking that question? Exactly which question should I be embarrassed about, sir?
You can ask me whatever you want. I'm just stunned that you're not embarrassed by some of the questions you ask.
I noticed that
RT very rarely asks any tough questions of their own government.
I do not expect the State Department to like my questions. In fact, I think the better the questions, the less they like it. But I also did not expect the State Department to say I should be embarrassed to ask my questions.
Friday was the scheduled deadline for the close of the UN climate conference negotiations in Paris, but it appears the horse trading will continue at least into the weekend. It was hoped agreement on a new universal climate deal would be reached by Friday, but negotiators at the COP21, saying they need more time to reach consensus on a number of important issues, announced that the negotiations have been extended at least through Saturday. Cristina Silveria was at the summit, and she filed this report.
Negotiators worked through the night on the climate deal, but as a new day dawned in Paris, it became clear that more time would be needed to reach a final agreement. At midday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon took to the podium here at COP21 and said he was encouraged by the progress that had been made overnight.
This morning, we have a much cleaner, streamlined text. This is a good basis of further negotiations.
The UN chief told reporters that the talks were highly complex and an agreement on a number of key issues had yet to be reached.
By any standard, by far, this negotiation is most complicated, most difficult, but most important for humanity.
Foreign Affairs Minister and COP21 President Laurent Fabius also briefed the press, saying he planned to present an updated text on Saturday morning. Mr. Fabius went on to say that he was optimistic and, quote, we are almost there. Cristina Silveiro, United Nations, reporting from COP21 in Paris.
The surprise outcome of last Sunday's legislative election in Venezuela has been a hot topic of conversation here among our analysts over the past week. But there's been one important voice missing from our discussion thus far, and we're going to remedy that right now as we bring you the voice of our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We spoke with him from Managua, Nicaragua, via Skype Friday.
Quite a shock last Sunday. I was shocked.
Especially the two-thirds majority.
Yeah, and if they'd won by a small margin, it would have been a kind of, a mild surprise. But the extent of the right-wing opposition's win in Venezuela was a real shock. And the only thing I can compare it with in my own life, in my own lifetime, was the 1990 defeat of the Sandinista government after 10 years of war. And I think the events in Venezuela over the last year, or longer than that, ever since Nicolas Maduro, even since before Nicolas Maduro became president. Events in Venezuela have been very similar to a war, short of outright military aggression, because the United States, for example, President Obama declared Venezuela a threat to the United States national interest, didn't he?
And security, yeah.
Yeah, and there's been a fierce economic war by the local big business interests in Venezuela, deliberately trying to destabilize the government, create shortages, provoke inflation, which is now up in three digits now, after having been under control for quite a long time. It's now kind of got completely out of control, and very significantly right in the run up to these last elections. So I think it's not an unfair comparison to compare the defeat of the PSUV and its allies in the legislative elections last Sunday with the defeat suffered by the Frente Sandinista in 1990. But the big difference is that the Venezuelan progressive forces have a chance to correct the errors that they've made and to find new ways of confronting the outright economic war and psychological media war against them in a way that will enable them to recover their lost electoral support.
Now, it's an interesting comparison. There are obviously, objectively, some very serious differences. At the time that the Sandinistas lost in 1990, was it Violeta Chamorro won that election?
Yeah, that's right.
Number one, Nicaragua was more or less on its own, with the exception of Cuba. The Soviet bloc was in the process of imploding, so it wasn't really offering an awful lot of assistance in the face of the U.S. war that was being conducted against Nicaragua over the course of the 80s. In the follow-up, and in addition to that, as much as they had tried, given the conditions that the external conditions imposed on Nicaragua during the 80s, they didn't have the same opportunity to build up the kinds of structures inside the country that the Bolivarian Revolution has had over the past 16 years. And again, where Nicaragua was fairly isolated during that period, Venezuela was anything but. The conditions in the region have changed dramatically in the period from 1990 until now. So what do you think of the process? Well, first of all, maybe you could fill in our audience some, remind people of the history from, say, I don't know, you want to start in 1979 or 1990, but what's happened in Nicaragua, because the revolution has been back and very busy.
Yeah, and I wrote that to some friends in Venezuela. I wrote to them, look, you know, and this is very similar to what happened to us here in Nicaragua in 1990. Very, you know, very dispiriting and disappointing results, and you know, it's natural to feel downhearted, but that passed and this will too. And so what happened in 1979, let's go back to 1979 in Nicaragua, a united Nicaraguan people, a revolutionary front including the most of the middle class, such as it was in those days in Nicaragua, they overcame the 45 years of military dictatorship under the Somoza family, instituted a government of national reconstruction that quickly fell into disagreement, and the middle class business interests that had originally worked with the Frente to overcome the dictatorship parted company with the FSLN, with the Sandinistas, and the Sandinista front was left to govern the country on its own. And immediately Ronald Reagan took power after the administration of President Carter, Ronald Reagan imposed an economic blockade, started funding terrorist fighters, very similar to what's happening in what the United States under President Obama have been doing in Syria and what they did in Libya, funding terrorists to destabilize the government. Engaging in an economic blockade, applying sanctions, the whole package, the psychological warfare, the whole package was applied to Nicaragua back in the 1980s, all through the 1980s. Nicaragua had its very first democratic election in 1984, which was won by the Frente Sandinista with something like 63-64% of the vote at that time. Daniel Ortega was elected president back then in 1984, although he was the first among equals because there was a kind of governing council of nine of the leaders of the Sandinista Front. And Daniel Ortega was kind of the first among equals among that group. And he and his colleagues tried to fend off the aggression of the United States between 1984 and 1990, held elections on schedule in 1990, much to the surprise of the United States and its allies. They engaged in the electoral process. The United States did what they've done in Venezuela, funded the opposition, strategized with them, helped them to an electoral victory that they won. It's very interesting in terms of the balance of opinion, both in Nicaragua and Venezuela, Nicaragua back then and Venezuela now, because, and I think we've had this discussion before, Don, in countries where there have been progressive governments, majority governments like Nicaragua, like Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, all these countries, Argentina, what you tend to find is that there's a core block of progressive opinion that translates into votes in any given election, and it's around 30-35% in most of these in these countries for progressive opinion, and then you have a block of solid right wing opinion that's usually around 20, can be as much as 25%, and that leaves let's say 35% of people in Nicaragua and Venezuela and the other countries are progressive, and 25% tend to vote for the right, support the right wing. That makes 60%. That leaves 40% of don't knows, you know, independents, call them what you like. And so that 40% becomes the electoral battleground, and that's what happened in 1990. In 1990, the enormous pressure of the threat of continuing war, the continuing economic blockade, that encouraged, to put it, you know, charitably, or blackmailed, if you want to put it uncharitably, that the 40% of don't knows and independents, and most of those then voted in 1990 for the right wing opposition. And you saw, and I think it's fair to say that a very similar thing happened in Venezuela last Sunday. You had 42% of the vote was for Nicolas Maduro's United Socialist Party of Venezuela, and I think the United Opposition, which is, I think it's a total of something like 13 different political groups that themselves hate each other. They managed to get something like 56% of the vote, and that bears out. It's very similar to what happened in Nicaragua in 1990.
Right.
And so then what happened in 1990 was the right wing took power, engaged, tried to dismantle the revolutionary state that had been built up by the Sandinistas. They attacked the cooperative movement. They tried to roll back the land reform. They rolled back the taking into the public sector, or something like, I've forgotten how many it was. It was well over 100. State enterprises were privatized in a way that grossly favored, you know, on ridiculously favorable terms to the friends of Violeta Chamorro and her group. And so they expected to be able to destroy the Frente Sandinista, to destroy its electoral support. And at one point, it looked possible that they might be able to do it, because what happened was that a group led by Sergio Ramirez, the former vice president in the 1980s, took the Social Democrat route, tried to start a Social Democrat party, hijacked the Sandinista deputies in the National Assembly, who had been voted into office by the Frente, supporters of the Frente Sandinista, and Sergio Ramirez took, I forgot how many it was, he got well over 20 of them to follow his line. And there was an absolutely crucial Congress of the Frente Sandinista, I think it was in 1994, in which Daniel Ortega and his colleagues managed to recover the party. I think they expelled Sergio Ramirez and the group around Sergio Ramirez from the party. And then in the 1996 elections, that was a key election because the Frente Sandinista, although they lost the election, they maintained their block of 35 or 36 deputies in the National Assembly. The group around Sergio Ramirez, I think they got one deputy or two deputies in those 1996 elections. And from that base, Daniel Ortega and his colleagues worked to defend the gains of the revolution through the 1990s, and they succeeded in such a way that by 2001 they almost won that election. They did very well in the 2001 presidential elections, but in other areas, in the municipal level, they built up very, very solid support. They steadily gain more and more control of more and more municipalities. There are 153 in Nicaragua. And then what happened in 2001 was that the right wing split. And what Daniel Ortega was able to do was he exploited the divisions in the Nicaraguan right wing. And that is what enabled him to win the election in 2006 with around 38% of the vote. He won with 38% of the vote because the right wing was divided. Now, if you look at that history and put it and translate it, if you like, into what is likely to happen in Venezuela, as we said earlier, the huge advantage that Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues in the United Socialist Party of Venezuela have is that it was a legislative election that they lost. They didn't lose the executive. Right. And they still had, they still have control, if one wants to put it in those terms, of the judicial system through the Supreme Court. Right. They have a lot going for them, a lot more going for them than the Sandinistas did in 1990, certainly.
Right.
And so what's likely to happen is that because the right-wing parties hate each other so much and have all kinds of divisions among themselves, it's perfectly possible, and I think we'll see as things unfold, but it's perfectly possible that Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues will be able to exploit those divisions in exactly the same way that Daniel Ortega did. And they'll be doing so from a much stronger position than Daniel Ortega was in.
Yeah.
And so it's likely that as things develop, Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues will take the corrective action that they need to take, in particular in terms of fighting corruption and that kind of thing. And paradoxically, they're in a much stronger position to make economic changes that they would have been much more controversial prior to last Sunday's election.
Hmm.
So I think that given Nicaragua's history, and I don't think it's going to be 17 years. I don't think it's going to take 17 years for Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues to recover what they lost last Sunday, as which was the case in Nicaragua. It took 17 years. We here waited for 17 years for Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo to lead the Sandinista front back to power, if you like.
Yeah.
in Nicaragua, although in 2007 when Daniel Ortega took office, he was in again in a very weak position. And actually, he was in a position, the same position, that Nicolas Maduro is in now. He faced a legislature where the opposition had something like, I think they have 54 or 55 seats in, and against the 36 or 37 of the Sandinista Front. But even so, even despite the fact that the National Assembly, the legislature here in Nicaragua, was controlled by the right wing, Daniel Ortega was still able to implement his program despite all kinds of difficulties and attacks from the right wing, aided and abetted by the U.S. Embassy and other allied countries, in particular the Spanish, who... And also the Swedish ambassador played a key role at the time in trying to mobilize the right wing and organize the right wing and strategize with the right wing so as to create difficulties for the Sandinista government. But despite that, Daniel Ortega implemented his program. And in 2011, in the following presidential elections, he won a famous victory with over 60% support.
Right.
So, you know, and that's so to translate all that into what's happening in Venezuela now. So Maduro has had a setback. They've definitely had a very severe setback, especially in terms by the margin of their loss in the legislature. But paradoxically, that will create a situation in which Maduro and Diosdado Cabello and Elias Cao and all those very talented leaders of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela will actually have more room to be able, more margin to do what they need to do in order to recover the situation and actually improve the processes, the revolutionary processes that they've been working so hard on ever since 1998, when before 1998, when President Hugo Chavez took office in Venezuela back then.
You know, so you were referring to, you know, gave a brief outline of the history there in Nicaragua, and some of the things that were in play in 1990 when the Chamorro won, and that the right was attempting to, you know, some of the things they were attempting to roll back were things that were constructed during the 1980s, even under a state of siege, literally. And there was quite a bit, actually, that had been constructed during that time. There was the literacy campaign. There was medical care made available to people. There were attempts to address extreme poverty that were successful, particularly given the objective conditions of, you know, being under in a state of war, basically.
Right.
Those things build constituencies of people that have health care for the first time in their lives don't just walk away from it when a right-wing government's elected and says you can't have that anymore. They don't generally do that willingly. People that can read, for example, don't become illiterate again when a right-wing government comes into power. What has been accomplished in Venezuela because of the, you know, different conditions that they had, and just in general, objectively, things, you know, were more favorable than things were for Nicaragua in the 80s. They've constructed a great deal of things. One of the things we've talked about a few times is, for example, they're going to finish their 1 millionth housing unit this month out of a population of 30 million. That's a lot. It's like a sixth of the population has new housing that before.
Yeah, massive achievement.
They're not going to go gently into that good night, those people, no matter what decrees come out of the new assembly. If you look at the focus, it seems from what Maduro said the other day that one of the things they're looking to do is activate the grassroots and get on with the, maybe we can't get funding from the from this group in the National Assembly to do some of the construction of the apparatus of socialism that we wanted. We still have hands, we still have each other, and we still have what's been built so far. He's looking to move, to continue constructing socialism within whatever the political context ends up being. What kind of tasks do you think are before them, and how, I mean, it's an interesting approach to it, and it's one that's been discussed in theory before, but this is going to be a very significant example of praxis here. The answer to that rather long-winded question, and more, next week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.